Welcome to the Minor Consult, where I speak with leaders shaping our world in diverse ways. Today, I'm joined by Sally Sussman, Chief Corporate Affairs Officer at the global pharmaceutical giant Pfizer. An accomplished executive, Sally's career spans from Capitol Hill to the Clinton administration to senior communications roles at American Express, Estee Lauder, and now Pfizer. In 2022, she was named among the world's most influential chief marketing officers by Forbes for her work to combat health misinformation and shape the narrative around the COVID-19 vaccine. Her first book, out last year, is Breaking Through, Communicating to Open Minds, Move Hearts, and Change the World. Sally, welcome to the Minor Consult. It's great to have you here today.
Oh, thank you so much, Lloyd. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Sally, your book is tremendous. It's a blend. It's both a memoir and it's a business book, a business manual. There's a principle that bridges both genres, and that is the courage to be candid. How has prioritizing authenticity served you in your life and in your career?
Oh, thank you. That's a great question. I always wanted to write a book. I love to read and to write. And as you mentioned, Breaking Through is my first book. So before I turned it in to my publisher, the Harvard Business Review, I shared copies with a few close friends and family. And my mom read it and she called me up and she said, "Sally, this is not a business book. It's a memoir, one in which you share all your most embarrassing mistakes." And I laughed, but I knew she had a point, which is if you want to tell impactful stories, if you want to touch people and reach them and hopefully change their minds, open their minds, move hearts, as the book says, you really need to tell your story honestly and with courage. I have never been a huge fan of the business book. I love personal stories. I love histories, biographies. And so the fact that you see it as a melding of the two makes me feel really good. At the end of the day, you know, they say, write what you know. I've spent most of my career in business. So yes, it is a business book, but a deeply personal one.
And over your career, you've now worked alongside 9 different CEOs as they led some of the world's most influential companies. What's an unexpected leadership lesson that you've learned through them?
Thanks. You know, I have been fortunate to work for 9 CEOs, as you say, as well as cabinet secretaries and elected officials, and they're all really talented people. You don't get to those positions, to the corner office, by luck. You get there because you've worked hard, you've studied, you've put in your time. But as I watch them closely, I notice that a few of them really break through. They are the ones that can change a paradigm, really make a leadership difference. And for me, those 3 were Ken Chenault in his leadership of American Express, Leonard Lauder in his, you know, drive to make a small family business into a multi-billion-dollar empire, and Albert Bourla, my current CEO and boss at Pfizer, who was largely unknown at the start of the pandemic and now is a very prominent figure on the leadership horizon. And that difference was those 3 knew that communications is not a soft skill. It's a rock-hard competency. And they invested as much into their communications as they did into any of the important business disciplines of sales, finance, inventory management. And they really worked on it, and they prepared, and they took time. And it wasn't sort of, oh, we did all this other work, and now I'll spend 30 seconds getting ready to communicate it. And so for me, that was what made the difference and why I made the premise of my book about, you know, don't think it's a soft skill. It's a hard, rock hard competency of leadership.
On that topic of the importance of communications and, of course, your role in working with, as you said, cabinet leaders, CEOs and others, what are the principles that you talk about with the leaders you're working with? And what are the principles that have been most important to you as you've helped to shape the messages for these companies, for government officials, and ultimately in the work that you do every day?
Sure. So the book is divided into 10 chapters. Each one represents a very specific leadership skill, competency that I feel is necessary to be an extraordinary communicator. And I'll mention just a few. The first one is about being intentional. So many people start talking before they really know what they want to say. And I've taken intentionality to an extreme, perhaps. But, you know, before I speak with my parents, I say, try to be patient, Sally. Or before I speak to my daughter, try not to be judgmental. Just listen. That's my intention. Or before I came on to your podcast today, I took a moment and said, I hope I can provide Dean Miner's audience with some good insights. And so I really encourage intentionality. Another one, and I'll just list a few, but another one is to have the courage for candor. You know, there's that may be the most important one. And in this section of the book, I share my coming out story that happened when I came out in the mid-80s. It was a very different time for gay people in this country, and it was a big risk, and you know, it was a difficult conversation with my family, but in the long run, it gave us a more authentic relationship and brought us closer. So I'm always advocating for candor, even if it's something as simple as you owe someone an apology. Don't wait. Go ahead and do it, even if you feel the rift is very great. Or to tell someone that you love them, even if you're afraid it maybe isn't reciprocal. Candor is what gets the conversation going and what opens those hearts to connection. Maybe I'll list just one more, and sure. I'll take curiosity. You know, you're there at a great institution of learning in the medical field, and we can't be great communicators and leaders if we aren't continuously curious and asking ourselves, how can we be more creative in the work that we do? So each of these 10 principles are detailed with examples and great stories of accomplishment from other leaders about how they've done it, and tries to be a practical guide to leadership through better communications.
That's really helpful, and I recommend, as I said before, I think your book's fantastic, and I think the way in which you describe the principles that you just gave us an overview of in the book is really quite meaningful. Another feature of your career, Sally, is that you've seen an evolution in the way in which we as a society communicate, you know, with the rise of social media. And also we've seen sort of societal trends or mores change over the course of the past decade in profound ways. What are some of the take-home messages that you think are most important for those of us in roles that involve the type of communication that you write about and that you just spoke about? What should we be keeping in mind today, and how has that changed, say, from 20 years ago when the media through which we communicated were quite different than they are today?
Oh, you're so right. Things have changed dramatically. And I see the changes as being twofold. One is what you mentioned, the rise of social media and multiple channels, you know, TikTok, Instagram, all of these, you know, high-tech, super-fast ways of communicating. And the other was really the rise of a stakeholder mindset among the public, that people were identifying as, I'm an AIDS survivor, I'm an environmentalist, you know, all these kind of identity politics, and people's belief that as stakeholders, they deserve a say and they want to be engaged. So for big institutions, companies like Pfizer or Stanford, before all of this, they could control the message and the scene. You know, we used to announce things at our companies by way of a press conference. You don't really have press conferences much anymore because things are happening in such quick real time. Or we would deliver our financial results in our annual report, i.e. once a year. Now people are getting our financial updates every 15 seconds as people are watching tickers that give them information they never had before. So all of this led to a need for a different set of muscles, of people running departments like mine, whose real sole purpose is to build bridges between our institutions and the most important stakeholders that we have. So at Pfizer, our most important stakeholders are certainly patients, doctors, and our colleagues that work here. And what I learned from it and what I take away from it is it's less about the channel and always more about the message and the storytelling. You know, the story will always win. Story is what people will remember. Story is what will impress and move them. And you do have to tailor it to your channels, but channels shouldn't dominate. Content should dominate, in my view.
And on that topic of the story and how to get the message out and how to do it in a way that's meaningful to so many groups that identify along the lines of identities, as you just mentioned, how in this world of immediacy, how do you think about getting a proactive message out? There are always going to be 100, 1,000 demands for reactive messages today. And I'm sure you spend a lot of your time with you and your colleagues crafting, drafting, and preparing those reactive messages. But how do you step back and decide upon, well, what is the story? What's the vision that we really want to convey? Is that something that enters into the dynamic of planning communications for you?
You bet. We spend a ton of time trying not to be reactive. You could easily be reactive 24/7 with the amount of incoming. And that incoming is just, happening faster and faster. And so I stepped back a couple years ago and worked with my colleagues to come up with a framework for proactivity. And if you don't mind, I'd love to take a few minutes to just walk us through it. I have 5 questions that we use to get ourselves on front foot. And the first one is, does this issue relate to our purpose? At Pfizer, our purpose is breakthroughs that change patients' lives. But there are so many issues out there coming at us. Then they're important issues. Deforestation of the rainforest. It's an important issue, but it's not one that we should be commenting on, because if individuals or institutions comment on every issue, they lose their voice and they lose their agency. The second issue we ask ourselves is, how does this impact our most important stakeholders? And as I mentioned, for us, that's patients, doctors, and employees. And, try to think about what is it they need to know. And say that and not a whole lot more than that. Really focus on what do our folks need to know. The third one is, how does this issue relate to our values? Pfizer has 4 values: courage, excellence, equity, and joy. And if it's about those things, we have language and ideas that we want to express. It should never be about our politics or secondary issues that so many people get involved in. And we've seen today many higher education institutions torn apart by politics. And that's why I prefer values over politics. The fourth question I always ask is, what are our choices here? Because too often we're responding to a reporter on deadline or somebody pushing a petition in our face and saying, all the other companies have signed, you have to sign on too. And I say, no, we don't. And what I often prefer is to, pick up my pen, write something out, share it with our colleagues, and post it on our website in our own voice, in our own words, and not under some false pressure of someone else's timetable. And then the last thing we always have to ask ourselves to be proactive is, what are the potential repercussions of what we do? Because one of the biggest mistakes, Lloyd, that people make in communications is to ping pong between positions. You know, I don't like to speak negatively of others, but it was pretty widely seen what happened at Disney in Florida on the Don't Say Gay bill, where, you know, first they were for it and then they were against it. And in the end, you know, everybody was mad. And so it's really worth taking an extra moment, taking a beat, thinking things through, speaking clearly in your own voice, because once an institution takes a position, it's really treacherous to step away from it and try to change or walk it back or any of that. So those are my five questions and in my framework. I love getting input from others who might be listening if they have different frameworks. It's an evolving art.
Indeed, it certainly is. And maybe using those five principles as a starting point, if we turn now to the pandemic, where there were many competing interests that wanted to communicate different messages about the virus, about the vaccine, about everything, about the public health response to the pandemic, how were you able to break through this chaotic, you know, communications environment during the pandemic and today as well, to help Pfizer communicate its narrative?
Chaotic is a very good descriptor of the experience that we were in. And I think during the pandemic, if I were handing out grades, I would give the science an A+. mRNA technology was a huge breakthrough. I would give the communications a C or a D. I think across the board, there was confusion, contradiction. The health leaders that we normally look to would change their opinions. And as we just said, that's never a good plan. And it was my job, along with my colleagues, to roll out this vaccine. And it was a brand new technology coming out at a time when people were frightened and the world was scared and locked down. And there were really two ways that I proceeded. Of course, we had a ton of data from our clinical trials, data from real-world evidence in some of the early adapting locations. And we had experts, our chief scientist, we had, you know, all kinds of R&D officials in the company and outside who were willing to help us. That was useful for some. But for many, it wasn't. In particular, politicians, sports heroes, you know, rock and roll stars reached out to us and they wanted to be helpful, which was very kind. But for those people who were deeply vaccine hesitant, those things did not move them. What did ultimately prove helpful was a different message and messenger than we originally thought. So not data, not experts at a certain point. It was personal stories. The people who said, I got to see my grandchild after 2 years because I was vaccinated. Or people who said, I got to get back on campus because I'm vaccinated. Personal stories and the most influential messengers in helping us get to those who were hesitant were the teacher, the preacher, the neighbor lady, the son, the daughter, the trusted known source. So it was a learning curve for me during this time, and one that I continue to try to think about and refine as we continue to try to build confidence. You know, in the end, about 85% of Americans took the vaccine, and I wish it were 100%.
Certainly. What are the best ways to think about and approach communicating uncertainty? I mean, it strikes me that one of the problems, challenges that you just mentioned about communications during the pandemic, in retrospect, a lot of things I think many people wished have been done differently. And we all remember the early days of the pandemic when we were washing fruits and vegetables, right? Because we, because why? Because I guess that's what we did.
Right. But
I don't think the scientific community necessarily did a good job of saying, I don't know, or we just don't have the data yet. What's the best way to do that? And is that that's something that you've coached leaders you've worked with on? And of course, it's not a satisfactory answer in a sense, because particularly during the pandemic, it's not what people wanted to hear. We wanted to know, how do we make this thing go away? And how do we ensure that we're going to be healthy through it? So any principles you can give us about communicating in an honest way through stories like you were describing when we simply don't know the answer?
Absolutely. And you said it very well. I think one of the most authentic answers a person can give is, I'm not sure, but I'll find out and come back to you. And take a breath, take a moment, consult your advisors, and, you know, say, we'll know more in 2 weeks, or we'll have better information after the readout of the next trial. When the pandemic hit, you know, as you said, there were, it was such a fraught time, and there were so many lessons that we're still learning. And my CEO, Albert Bourla, was a new CEO. He had become CEO just a few months prior. And he had to kind of wear a double hat during the time, because not only was he, you know, the CEO of Pfizer, because we were, you know, a leading vaccine maker, he became something of an educator in chief to society, spending a lot of time out there talking. And I'm very proud of the job that he did, because he didn't always, you know, put on the bold face and say, you know, yes, 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 we know everything. We went through this together as a society. I too washed my fruits and vegetables, you know, and we have to be understanding of one another and have confidence as leaders that that doesn't mean we know everything. And, you know, the media was very aggressive during this time frame, and sometimes they would ask me a question. I would give them my answer and stop, finish when I had completed my thought. And then they would use silence as a way to try to, you know, force a leader into saying more. We have to, as leaders, be disciplined to say really only what we do know. And we are not gods. We are not all-knowing. At times, we have to simply say, I don't have that information just now. I look forward to getting it, and we'll come back to you.
Of course, in addition to being able to communicate uncertainty, we've also had the challenge of confronting and communicating about misinformation in health and in medicine. In your experience, what are the most effective ways that we as healthcare professionals can counter misinformation when we hear it, when we see it?
Great question. The most important thing in my mind is differentiating between misinformation and disinformation. To me, misinformation is really just people don't know, they don't understand, they've been given wrong information. And for people like that, I have all the time in the world. Many people who were originally vaccine hesitant or skeptical, they'd had a bad experience either with a vaccine or perhaps with the healthcare system at large. And for those people, I find listening, taking time, answering questions patiently has a real impact. Disinformation is something very different. And to me, it's the current epidemic. We are in an epidemic of disinformation, very destructive, very hurtful. And oftentimes, it's people who are knowledgeable of the truth, but are masquerading as journalists, putting forward falsehoods. Their motivations are often to gain followership, to raise money off of negative storylines and narratives. And I work a lot with my peers, and I call upon all of us, people of good conscience, to stick together and fight this with the same vigor that we did. And we fight it by unmasking it, calling it out, you know, not cowering, but having the courage to speak truth to power. Well, not truth to power, but truth to disinformation.
Humor can be very effective in breaking down the ice in a communications endeavor, in building trust, but it can also run the real risk of alienating others. You've spoken and written about the use of humor and effective communications. And what can you share with us today about what leaders should be thinking about in how they express themselves publicly? We know many people that in one-on-one are, and I think all of us are much more relaxed in an environment in with people we know that have known us for ages, where a misplaced word or something is not going to have an effect on the relationship or our ability to communicate. But that's very different in a public environment. And yet we've seen so many examples where humor has helped. And so what's your thinking now about the role of humor, and how do you counsel the leaders that you work with in their communications about the use of humor?
So I mentioned that the book has 10 chapters, each an idea. The hardest one to write was the one on humor.
Yeah.
Humor has gotten really tough these days, but humor, as you say, can really help. And I'm reminded of a trip I took to Africa several years back, and I was traveling with Albert Bourla, who at the time was not my CEO, but my colleague and my friend. And we were in a small village, and I was leading the trip. It was a trip to review some of Pfizer's philanthropic work, some of our drug and health access work. We were at a maternal clinic, and we were just wrapping up and gathering to leave and resting for a moment in the shade. And some of the local elders came over to talk to us, and a man who looked very important in the mix came up to me, and he said that he wanted to trade me for two of his cows. And I was speechless, Lloyd. I'm a woman executive. I am a feminist. I will not be traded for two cows. And I was nervous and I was sweating. And Albert sort of came up from the back, and he'd been quiet on most of the trip. I wasn't sure what Albert would say. But he got right in this guy's face and he said, "Sir, this woman is a senior executive at Pfizer. She will not be traded for less than six cows." And by making a joke, Albert knew that this was a situation that would be best diffused with humor. The gentleman had no intention of trying to trade me. He was being funny, and I was wrong not to see it. But sometimes that happens, and humor can really deflect. And so I stick with humor as an important leadership philosophy, because I don't want to live in a world where we can't be joyful and where we can't laugh. In my department here at the company, every summer we have something called Open Mic Night. And we put up a microphone and we gather at the end of the day and have some refreshment. And we stand up and we share our biggest goof, something that we've done. And we try to embellish it with some storytelling. You know, the person who left a confidential document on the subway. And, you know, we all do it. We all make mistakes. But those mistakes are leavened with humor. And when we can bring humor to our daily lives, we're able to feel less ashamed, more at home, and to go forward in a good spirit. So I am committed to continuing to try to create environments that can be lighthearted. I'm not talking about being the court jester, you know, or telling dirty jokes or anything like that. It's not stand-up comedy. It's a spirit. It's a spirit that we are human, and humor and humanity go hand in hand.
Let's continue on that theme of joy. And you mentioned before that joy is a core value at Pfizer, and you just talked about how in your group you have open mic days. Can you share a bit more about your advice to leaders and how they build an environment, a workplace, a culture that values joy? And what are the principles for really bringing joy to the workplace And what have you found effective in your various executive roles with the people you're leading?
Sure. No, thank you for mentioning that we have a value of joy. When we were creating our new set of values back in 2019, the first one that we came up with was courage. I mean, if you know, if you're in a risky enterprise like R&D, you have to have some courage. And yes. The second one was excellence. You know, global company, putting our medicine in their bodies. Third is equity. Equity in healthcare is extremely important. And we kind of thought we were done. We were pretty much ready to call it a day. But my CEO said, you know, I just feel something's missing. What about happiness? And, you know, happiness is a great thing, but we can't always be happy. I mean, happiness isn't always available to us. But joy felt like an aspiration worth really embracing. And I love it. It's not corporate. I challenge people to find another, you know, Fortune 50 pharma company or any kind of Fortune 50 company that has joy in their values. It's distinctive and it's different, and we love it. But then we had to say, well, but what does it mean? What does it actually mean? And so the ideas behind it are things such as we take our jobs seriously, but not ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's a very, very important principle. Take the work seriously, but don't take yourself so seriously. I say that a lot to young people. And the other one is that laughter's good medicine too. You know, the feeling we have when we laugh and when we laugh together is so meaningful. We spend so much time at our offices with our colleagues that, you know, putting a little effort towards celebration, recognition, joy is really very empowering.
Well, Sally, this has been a wonderful conversation. I want to end with two questions that I ask all my guests. First, what do you think are the most important qualities for a leader today?
Well, you know, as a person who's devoted her life to the communications and corporate affairs function and written a book about it, I'm going to double down right here on communications as the most important differentiator for leaders today.
I think that certainly resonates with me, and I bet it does with a lot of our listeners as well. And my second question is, what gives you hope for the future?
Well, I am not a scientist myself, but medical breakthroughs give me a lot of hope. When I was in my early 20s, I had friends who were dying of AIDS. People in our world today have long life prospects of a manageable chronic condition. My mom, who I mentioned at the top of your show, she has lupus. She's had it for 40 years. It's a tough disease, but while there's no cure, there are advances that give her a great quality of life. I think the future for oncology is very, very bright. So scientific advance in the medical sphere gives me a ton of optimism.
Well, Sally, thank you so much. And thank you for listening to the Miner Consult with me, Stanford School of Medicine Dean Lloyd Miner. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation and discussion with Sally Sussman, Chief Corporate Affairs Officer at Pfizer. Please send your questions by email to theminerconsult@theminerconsult.com and check out our website, theminerconsult.com, for updates, episodes, and more. To get the latest episodes of The Miner Consult, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please rank the podcast 5 stars. Your feedback helps make this podcast happen. Thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to our next episode. Until then, stay safe, stay well, and be kind.